Ave listeners, a quick announcement before the new podcast commences. Rhiannon Evans and I are now fundraising for Series 2 of the Caesar's Gallic War podcast, in which we make our way through Caesar's most famous campaign in intricate detail. This is a supporter-only podcast, so if you want to hear it, why not check it out? Go to kickstarter.com and search for Caesar's Gallic War. Thanks. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University, Frankfurt. This is episode CXXIII. Here comes the sun. Macrinus has made a treaty with the Parthians, and at long last, the two mighty empires are at peace. Who's to say if it will last? But at this point in time, all that matters is that he can finally get down to the business of ruling the empire. But before he can rest his laurels, to the east, the sun is rising. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
The Severan family returns to Emesa, where Macrinus has sent them. This is an inland city in Syria on the Orontes River, south of Antioch. This is where Septimius Severus had met his future wife, Julia Domna, and Macrinus sent the other relatives back there. So I can take everyone through the different names.
Yeah, give us a bit of a family tree.
I hope everyone's got their pen and pencil ready to go. So Julia Domna had a sister, Iulia Maesa, and she was married to a man named Gaius Iulius Avitus Alexianus. He was a senator who accompanied Septimius Severus to Britain and then Caracalla on his eastern campaigns. We know, actually, that Maesa went with him. At the end of Caracalla's reign, Caracalla sent Alexianus to Cyprus, and he died on the way there. But Maesa and Alexianus had two daughters. The first was Iulia Soemias, and she was married to an equestrian from Syria called Sextus Varius Marcellus. He began an equestrian career and then became a senator, was a loyal supporter of Caracalla, but he died in Caracalla's reign. His sarcophagus is actually now in the Vatican Museum. You can go and see it there today. And it records his career in both Latin and Greek. And it records his equestrian posts as well as his senatorial ones, and said it was dedicated by his wife and their children. It's a wonderful inscription, and it's in the publicly accessible areas of the Vatican today. I think it's in the octagonal courtyard. When you pass through the tombs of the Scipios, you then go to the octagonal courtyard. It's near where the lagoon is. The other daughter, Somis's sister, Julia Mamia, who was married to Gessius Marcianus, another equestrian procurator from Syria. Each of the sisters, Soemias and Mamia, married to these Syrian equestrians, had sons. So Julia Soemias had a boy called Varius Avitus Bassianus, who was born either in 203 or 204. So at this point in time, he's probably 13, 14. And Julia Mamia had a son called Gessius Bassianus Alexianus, who was born in 208. So he's 9, 10 years old at the moment. And I apologise for the similarity in their names.
I don't think you need to apologise for that.
So what I do at the moment is I'll refer to Soemias' son as Varius Avitus and Mamia's son as Alexianus.
But later on they'll be known as...
Later on they'll be known as Elagabalus and Severus Alexander.
So these are the next two emperors.
The next two emperors of Rome. I do apologise because they're also given many nicknames as well.
Yeah, that messed me up. We'll get into that. It's a very matriarchal dominated family by the sounds of it. Maesa has a real hold over the family and is a real power broker. it does get away from her a yes. bit, but yeah.
It's really interesting to see the narrative. Herodian portrays the coup against Macrinus as being motivated chiefly by Mysa, by her desire to return to the palace, to return back to the power that she used to hold. Dio gives a more nuanced view, particularly there's a male associate who I'll get to, who is having an affair with Sormias, who is another prime mover. But it is very important that it's these women who provide the link for their sons to come to power. So we saw under Caracalla the prominence of Julia Domna as an imperial mother.
Mm.
In a way we really haven't seen since Nero and Agrippina in the early years of Nero's reign. Once again, under the Severan boy emperors Elagabalus and Severus Alexander, we see their mothers and their grandmother, Mysa, playing a key role in the regime.
These two boys would be second cousins to Caracalla and Geta. Is that about right?
Yeah, they'd be cousins, yes. I'm not quite sure what's the difference between a first and second cousin. Probably shows my ignorance.
Maessa and Julia Domna are sisters.
Sisters.
So Caracalla is cousins to their mothers.
Their mothers, yeah.
So
they'll be second cousins.
Second cousins.
Yes, so they're second cousins. And it's interesting that these women and their boys were part of Caracalla's court. So we have an inscription from Asia Minor which shows that Varius Avitus Bassianus, the future Elagabalus, was part of the court. So Mysa, Alexianus, Sormias are moving through with Julia Domna, with Caracalla.
Mm.
So they've really been an important part of the regime for a long time. And this is important because they'll get to know senators, equestrians, officers, soldiers. They're not people who are coming from nowhere in the backyards of Syria. They're a real key part of the regime.
And they've got a whole other life that they're grown accustomed to and are going to miss as a result. But what function did the family have back home in Emesa?
The men of the family had been priests of the sun god. Varius Avitus and Alexianus are both involved in the worship of the sun god Emesa. And Avitus, according to Herodian, was actually the priest in charge of the cult, despite being a teenager. Mm. But this is an office which has been held by his ancestors, being passed down through the family. So the cult of the sun god there is known as Elagabal. This is an Aramaic word, which means God Mountain. And it refers to the mountain of Emesa. Mountain cults are a key part of religion in the eastern region. And the god itself was worshipped as a stone, a conical stone representation, which is known as a bital.
Mm.
This is the cult image of the god Elagabal. Herodian has a lovely description of the young Varius Avitus in 5.3.7.
This is Avitus in action, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So, no, he's a young man, 13, 14. And Herodian says, in the prime of his youth, he was the handsomest lad of his time, with physical beauty, bloom of youth, and splendour of attire combining to produce the same effect. The youth might well be compared to the handsome statues of Bacchus.
So when you've got these people who provide a direct link to Caracalla, who the army admired, who paid the army well, that's a rallying point. I'm a bit surprised that Macrinus leaves such a solid link behind.
It is a major tactical error on his part. You might remember when Caracalla came to power, he tried to extinguish as many remnants of the Antonine family as he could.
He did. He got rid of Marcus Aurelius's daughters, didn't he?
That's right,
yeah.
Yes. And the son of Pertinax as
he
well.
He did, yes.
And also his own cousin, who was called Septimius Severus, like his father.
Yeah.
So he was trying to really clean house there. Macrinus takes a more merciful route, which would ultimately prove his undoing.
So the military would see this family and see this as an opportunity?
Definitely. And there was a legion close by to Emesa. Mm. This is the Legio III Gallica, the third Gallic legion, quartered at Raphanea near Emesa. They would often, Herodian says, go to Emesa on the pretext of worshipping the god, but thereby delighted in watching Varius Avitus in his role as the priest. So he's a beautiful young boy who is capturing their eyes. Now, according to Herodian, Mysa, this is Varius Avitus' grandmother, the sister of Julia Domna, she spreads a rumour that Varius Avitus is actually the bastard son of Caracalla. Caracalla slept with both of her daughters, who were young and beautiful. And the rumour starts to spread throughout the army that Caracalla's son is alive and well. This is very interesting. It's the first instance of someone claiming to be an emperor's illegitimate son to claim the throne of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, because there's been attempts before, I'm sure.
Emperors had affairs with slave women and freed women, but their sons born from that, we don't ever hear of them.
Yeah.
So there surely would have been children born from these relationships, but they wouldn't have had the standing to really capitalize on it. I should say the other exception much earlier is Caesarion, the son of Caesar and Cleopatra,
yeah,
who really, you know, possibly posed a threat to the rise of
Octavian. That's when everything was getting started and before everything had shaken down and solidified into whatever you want to call the current practice, which seems to be changing all the time anyway.
Before there was a monarchy, essentially.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, someone saying, you know, Caracalla, he slept with a noble woman and, you know, I am his son. You know, it's kept all within the family. It's essentially, you know, an incestuous relationship. Sorry, I should say it actually wouldn't be defined as incest by the Roman law because it's with cousins and that's actually acceptable. But it's an important step in the Roman Empire.
And it doesn't hurt that Avitus does apparently resemble Caracalla.
Yes, yes. And that's plausible. He's part of the same family.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
It's plausible that they have a resemblance, especially when someone is youthful. So the youthful busts of Caracalla make him look like quite a sweet child, actually, before everything goes wrong. Now, Herodian, again, sticking with Herodian, it's Mysa who buys the loyalty of the army. She doesn't want to lose power. The whole family goes to the army camp at night, the camp of the 3rd Gallic Legion, and Varius Avitus is declared Caracalla's son and emperor on the 16th of May, 218. Dio describes the events differently. So he has a certain man called Eutychianus, who is an ally of the family from Emesa. He's an important male figure. Now, unfortunately, there are lacunae in this part of Dio's manuscript, so it's possible that Eutychianus is identical with another man called Gannis, who is the lover of Julius Sormias, Varius Avitus's mother.
Yeah.
So it's possible they're the same person. We're not quite sure because of the gaps in the manuscript. Mm. And we know that Dio often uses different names for people. Now, in Dio, Eutychianus brings Varius Avitus into the camp without Mysa's knowledge or the knowledge of Soimias.
Oh, so Dio takes the agency away from them.
He takes the agency away from the women. It's difficult to know. I find it implausible that they didn't know anything about what was happening, because given their roles in trying to control both boys as emperors, it doesn't seem plausible that they wouldn't know anything about the situation.
Mm.
It may be that Dio is using different sources there, or prefers to give agency to a man rather than a woman. Either way, Avitus is brought into the camp, and it's acclaimed by the soldiers as Marcus Aurelius Antoninus.
Jeez, just the greatest hits.
Yes, exactly. Remember that this is the name of Caracalla himself. Caracalla is a nickname.
Mm.
His father gives him the name of Marcus Aurelius Antoninus to consolidate the link with the Antonine family. Remember, Septimius Severus also adopts himself as the son of Marcus Aurelius.
Mm.
So this is now a dynastic name for the Severan dynasty. He's showing that he's part of the same family. Now, Dio calls Avitus the false Antoninus.
That's just one of Dio's nicknames for him.
One of many nicknames,
but yes. That's the one that he consistently brings up, isn't it?
Yes. Pseud Antoninus, he calls him. Yeah. So, and this is because he's really trying to undermine the dynastic claim to be part of the Antonine family.
Mm. So now we've got a rival claim to being Caesar, but you've got Macrinus, who seems to be more established at this point. Legitimate might be the wrong word, but he's got an even stronger claim is probably the wrong word. But, you know, he's been in the seat longer at least.
The Senate has recognised him as well.
Yes.
So he gave himself the titles, but the Senate did ratify them.
Yeah.
So Macrinus is in Antioch, north of Emesa.
Cultivating his beard.
Cultivating his beard. Yes, that's what emperors do in Antioch. And Macrinus sends his Praetorian prefect, Ulpius Julianus, to deal with the problem. But the men of the legion defect to Avitus, now Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. They cheer on the son of Caracalla, according to Herodian. Julianus' men desert from him, and he is beheaded. So it doesn't go well. Macrinus then advances to Apamea in Syria, where the Legio II Parthica is stationed. This is this mobile legion which always accompanies the emperors. So this is the base of his military power now that the detachment he sent with Ulpius Julianus has defected. So has the Legio III Gallica as well.
Mm.
He tries to win over the soldiers of the Legio II Parthica by raising his son and Caesar, Marcus Appellius Digimenianus, to Augustus, saying, "But look, there is a dynasty of my own," and he gives a lavish dinner and gives his soldiers 20,000 sesterces a head. However, there is a rather unfortunate delivery at this dinner party. So a head is delivered under the pretext that it's actually the head of Varius Avitus, who'd been recently acclaimed as the son of Caracalla. However, the head is actually not that of Avitus, it's of Macrinus's Praetorian prefect, Julianus.
Yeah, that's not something you want at a dinner party.
No. Macrinus is terrified, he flees back to Antioch, and the Legio II Parthica deserts to the new emperor.
Wow.
Varius Avitus.
He's just losing all these troops.
He is. They loved Caracalla.
Mm.
Remember, the reduction in the army pay got the army offside with Macrinus. Armies are attached to dynasties because dynasty means continuity. Continuity means the money and privileges keep flowing. But Macrinus himself, according to Dio, writes the Senate to abuse the false Antoninus. So we can really see how the name Antoninus is being contested during this period. He complains about the budgetary situation, explaining why he had to cut the pay for the new recruits.
Mm.
And then there's quite an amusing anecdote in Dio about how Macrinus ends the letter to the Senate. And this is 79.36.5. Macrinus says, "I realise that there are many who are more eager to see an emperor killed than they are to live themselves. But this I do not say with reference to myself, that anyone could either desire or pray that I should perish." At which Fulvius Digenianus, another senator, exclaimed, "We have all prayed for it." So he wasn't too popular.
That would have got a laugh out of the Senate.
I think so. It's another one of those witty bon mots that Dio records, which really brings the Senate to life during this period. But Macrinus decides that he has to join battle with Varius Avitus, the new emperor, and Avitus marches out to meet Macrinus in battle.
It's not often that it comes to this sort of civil war in Rome. It hasn't for quite a long time, not, I suppose, since Septimius Severus got rid of his rivals.
Yeah, since Clodius Albinus and Pescennius Niger.
Yeah.
You're actually getting two rival candidates to the throne meeting in battle. And once again, we're in Syria.
I was about to say, same region, yeah.
Yeah, near Antioch.
What is it about Syria?
It's near the eastern provinces, you know, it's a key...
It's far enough from Rome for there to be disquiet.
Exactly, and people can stage insurrections from that region. So battle is joined near Antioch on 8th of June 218. It's interesting, again, differences in Herodian's and Dio's accounts. In Herodion, the forces of Avitus and the Syrian branch fight with great spirit, and it's Macrinus' soldiers who don't, and many of his soldiers actually desert the Syrian branch. Then Macrinus runs away. In Dio, it's actually the army of Avitus and the Syrians which is not standing up to Macrinus. And then we have this wonderful scene when Mysa and Soemias, the Severan women, leap down from their chariots to exhort the men to fight, which is such a wonderful scene of these women inspiring the army. And then they see Avitus, this beautiful young boy, riding on horseback through the ranks, which once again inspires them to fight. You know, shades of Alexander the Great, you know, a young man and his horse riding through.
Dio doesn't lavish compliments on Avitus, on Elagabalus at all.
No.
So I'm inclined to say if he says that that happened, that it fair chance that it might have happened. It
probably did. Yeah. And I think, you know, it may well have been the case that the tide of battle turned several times. But whatever happens in both Dio and Herodion, the outcome is the same. Macrinus flees. He disguises himself, shaves his head, and travels overland through Syria and Asia Minor to try to get back to Rome. Eventually, he's recognized in Bithynia. So he gets, you know, to the far edge of Turkey at Chalcedon. His head is cut off, but his body remains unburied, Dio tells us, until the emperor, false Antoninus, makes his own way to Bithynia so he can gloat over the dead body. Presumably it'd be rather decayed several months later unless they've mummified it or something like that to keep preserved. And his son, the 10-year-old Digimenianus, is also captured and killed. I always feel sorry for the children who are caught up in these horrible events.
This isn't unique to young Avitus either, this sort of gloating thing. I remember Septimius Severus doing that over his rivals as well.
Oh, yes. They love to see their dead bodies and, you know, see actual proof of the revenge they have wreaked. They're not nice people, these Roman emperors.
Thus ends the short reign of the Emperor Macrinus. So how does the historians evaluate him?
Now, Dio has a rather ambivalent picture of Macrinus. He recognises his excellence as a jurist and an administrator, but then criticises him for taking the throne as an equestrian. So he says that Macrinus was a victim to a disaster he richly deserved.
Harsh, yeah.
It is very harsh. He says in 7940, Macrinus, though an old man, he was 54 years of age, lacking some 3 or 5 months, and distinguished for his practical experience of affairs, a man who displayed signs of excellence and commanded so many legions, was overthrown by a mere boy of whose very name he had previously been ignorant. As indeed the oracle had foretold to him, for upon his consulting the oracle of Zeus Belius, the god had answered him, "Truly indeed, old man, young warriors sorely best thee, spent is thy force, and grievous old age is coming upon thee." I think Dio is a bit unfair to Macrinus as emperor. The mere fact that he was an equestrian is not a good enough reason to denigrate his reign.
There is rank snobbery going on there.
Very much so.
Yeah.
We mustn't forget that Macrinus was Praetorian prefect. He was a chief advisor to the emperor, had judicial authority to hear cases in place of the emperor. And Macrinus did try hard to walk back some of the extravagances of Caracalla with the army pay. He made peace with Parthia, and then he tried to balance the considerations of the different factions within the Senate. He tried to appoint his own supporters to governorships in the region to consolidate that position, and he tried to put key allies in place in Rome as well. But he also bungled some appointments, and in that regard, he doesn't seem to have been entirely conscious of senatorial sensibilities, particularly the appointment of Oclotinius Adventus. You know, Macrinus thinks, here's my ally, but he's not the right man to establish a rapprochement with the Senate in Rome.
Mm. And then he makes decisions like replacing the governors with his own allies, which is probably a good thing to do, so you can trust those regions better.
Yes.
But you leave the Severans alive, and you show that act of mercy, which is leaving your flank open, really, for attack.
Yes. I mean, I think it's much to Aquinas' credit that he didn't kill them.
Yes, but he didn't kill children.
Yes, he didn't kill children, definitely. But speaking tactically, as a Roman emperor, they were a problem. You know, he did try and right things. You know, it was sensible to try and reduce the army pay, but that was never going to go down well. It's almost like he tried to do too much at once, a bit like Pertinax in a way, but Dio gives Pertinax the benefit of the doubt. So because of the hostile tradition against Macrinus, we do get some really exaggerated criticisms of him in the Historia Augusta.
Yeah, now that's the only source that we haven't really touched on here, just mainly because the perception is that it's mostly BS.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically made up. The life of Macrinus and also the life of his son Digimenianus.
That's a weird one. That's like, he's an emperor, I've got to give him a life.
Yes.
What do you write about a 10-year-old?
Yeah, so there has to be a life, you know, to be complete, but it's all just made up.
Yeah.
And so Marius Maximus's biographies were used for Septimius Severus, for Caracalla, and for Elagabalus. The first half of the life of Elagabalus is based on good sources, but the lives of Macrinus and Digimenianus aren't. And because of the hostile tradition about him, we have an entire section, chapter 12, the life of Macrinus, dedicated to his cruelty, in which the HA says Macrinus was arrogant and bloodthirsty and desirous of ruling in military fashion. Even crucified soldiers, and always used the punishments meted out to slaves. And when he had to deal with a mutiny amongst the troops, he usually decimated the soldiers, but sometimes he only centimated them. This last was an expression of his own, for he used to say that he was merciful in putting to death only 1 in 100, whereas they deserved to have 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 put to death. He goes on with an entire screed about his cruelty, which really has no basis in fact. There's really some quite despicable actions taken. So the HA, again in the same chapter, says there were some soldiers who had intercourse with their host's maidservant, who for some time had led a life of ill repute. Learning of their offence through one of his spies, he commanded them to be brought before him and questioned them as to whether it was really true. When their guilt was proved, he gave orders that 2 oxen of extraordinary size should be cut open rapidly while still alive, and that the soldiers should be thrust 1 into each, with their heads protruding so they could talk to each other. In this way he inflicted punishment on them, though neither our ancestors nor the men of his time ever ordained such penalty, even for those guilty of adultery.
It's definitely unusual punishment.
It's very creative. I think I would not have thought of that myself, you know.
Well, that's good.
That's good. Yeah, I'm not a sadistic Roman emperor. But yes, it's part of this tradition where tyrants don't just execute people. They do so in the most amazing ways to cause them maximum pain.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm just inclined to say none of this sort of behaviour or attitude or anything comes through in the other more reliable sources.
No. Even Dio, who is critical of Macrinus,
yeah,
does not attribute these things to him.
There's nigh an oxen harmed.
No, exactly. they make it out alive. So Macrinus is an emperor who really just didn't get the opportunity. He tried to reform things too quickly, and he got the army offside. If he had defeated Elagabalus, who knows what he would have gone on to do.
Mm.
He really did try and start his rule on a stable footing. The problem was that he wasn't given long enough to do that.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University, Frankfurt. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. please leave a review in said service. It's appreciated and it helps others find the podcast. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Elagabalus heads to the big city. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.